Anything we should be working on?
Yeah. You might practice walking without dragging your knuckles on the floor.
Albert, let's talk about knuckles. For the last time I knocked you down, I felt bad about it. The next time is going to be a real pleasure.
You listen to me. While I will admit to a certain cynicism, the fact is that I'm a naysayer and hatchet man in the fight against violence. I pride myself in taking a punch, and I'll gladly take another because I choose to live my life in the company of Gandhi and King. My concerns are global. I reject absolutely revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. I love you, Sheriff Truman.
Albert's path is a strange and difficult one.
And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, I led to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean Haglund, no matter how excited you are to get to your top 10 list, we have other news, other views to discuss. And of course we do, because we can't let a week go by, it seems, without celebrity deaths. And one of my all-time favorite character actors died this past week. The son of Oscar-winning actor Jose Ferrer and Rosemary Clooney, and cousin of George Clooney. Miguel Ferrer died at 61, and he was set to reprise his role as FBI agent Albert Rosenfeld on David Lynch's revival Twin Peaks, which premieres May 21st on Showtime. The good news for Miguel Ferrer fans is apparently he had completed shooting all of his work on the forthcoming revival. And, you know, between you and me, knowing as we do the creative impulse and the joy of what we do, I would imagine if he had not finished it, he may have made it long enough in order to finish it. You know, sometimes, especially for a character that he clearly loved so much. And sometimes it is the love of our work that keeps us going. Right?
That's true.
We've talked so much before, when someone is battling a disease and battling chronic pain, and of course, Miguel Ferrer was battling cancer, boy, it depletes you, and sometimes it's the love and the enjoyment of the work that can keep you going.
Right.
I played my favorite all-time clip from not only Twin Peaks, but from Miguel Ferrer's career at the opening from an episode of Twin Peaks where the cynical and sarcastic Albert Rosenfeld explains his personal nonviolent philosophy based on love, one that rejects absolutely vendettas and revenge. And boy, it also seems incredibly apt in the wake of not only Inauguration Day here in the U.S., but also 11 million protesters worldwide in the wake of Inauguration Day. So
yep.
Expressing and sharing a wonderful clip all about turning the other cheek and being willing to take a punch in the name of nonviolence and non-retribution certainly seems worthwhile. Miguel Ferrer joined the cast of CBS's popular spinoff NCIS Los Angeles in 2012, opposite Chris O'Donnell, LL Cool J, Linda Hunt, and others. That is a show that I've never watched a single minute of.
Nor I.
Much as I love Miguel Ferrer and his work. He came in early on as the assistant director of NCIS and at first was a hard-as-nails, unpleasant sort. But right. during the course of the ensuing seasons, his character Owen Granger warmed up to his colleagues and became a friend. And this description, as I understand it, really is the pattern of so many of Miguel Ferrer's characters through the years, an abrasiveness belying a rather golden heart, I guess you could say, became his stock in trade.
Right. Yeah. So I first was aware of him on RoboCop, of course. And
which he did not demonstrate that at all.
No.
That did not show that kind of range. And indeed, early on, it was just his sarcasm, his unctuousness and his sarcasm that made him make a name for himself. Because indeed, after launching his career in the early 80s with small guest starring shots on big hits like Magnum P.I. and Cagney and Lacey, and feature films including Heartbreaker and The Man Who Wasn't There, and Star Trek III: The Search for Spock, let us not forget. He plays an officer for another actor who is quite well known for unctuousness, James B. Sicking, who was the captain of the Excelsior. And Miguel Ferrer plays one of his junior officers. But after that, yeah, he has a real breakout in 87 for RoboCop as Bob Morton, the ambitious and sleazy corporate climber who spearheads the RoboCop program to great success, only to ultimately, spoiler alert, be murdered by his envious boss.
Spoiler alert. Jeez. Oh, my God.
But then what was nice is that door opened to bigger roles, such as Twin Peaks, where he comes out with all the same kind of, I don't know, abrasiveness. Not the sleaziness of RoboCop, obviously, but the abrasiveness of that character, and then being able to belie that by showing really surprising sides while still embodying the abrasiveness. That's the beauty of it. It's not he was this or that. He was still abrasive, even while revealing that he had a heart of gold.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually met him once. We were almost going to do a movie together.
Well,
did I ever tell you the story?
No, and this is fascinating to me. I met him once. I enjoyed a really good time at a party with him back in the 90s. Hung out for a long time that night talking with him, and it was great, great fun. Though I'd never actually let on to him what a big fan of his I was. It was a mellow atmosphere, and we were just chatting about life and everything.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and interesting that you would bring this up, because I was going to not only ask whether or not you admired his work, but I was going to ask whether or not you see any similarities in your own work.
Oh, well, fascinating. I guess I do, but it was interesting. We were going to do this movie. Do you remember that one I told you about a film crew out in the desert is being plagued by earthquakes, and then when they look, they see two tectonic plates coming at them at a mile an hour, basically, and they're trapped. So knowing their impending doom, they decide to finish the film. That was the script. And I thought the money was together, and then the whole project fell apart. But he was to be the director, and I was going to be one of the actors on there. It was, and so we had met briefly with the crew. We didn't rehearse anything, but
he was playing the director within the film, or he was going to direct?
Yeah, he was going to play the director within the film, and then I forget the actual director's name because the project fell apart. This was in the late 90s as well, so. So unfortunately, we never got to work together, but that would have been really fun had that all project hung out.
In 2001, he landed a role in the NBC drama Crossing Jordan, another show I never saw, though it was a top 20 show when it first hit the airwaves, and it remained on the air until 2007. I want to champion one particular title he was in, and it's not a great movie. I've probably never mentioned it before, but it was his one opportunity in films that I know of to show what he could have been as a leading man, and it's a movie called Where's Marlowe? It was a 1998 comedy mystery film written by Daniel Pyne and John Mankiewicz and directed by Daniel Pyne. And it was a failed TV pilot that was expanded into an indie feature under the short-lived Paramount Classics label. Like I said, it wasn't good, but it showed what Miguel Ferrer was capable of as a lead. And it's about a documentary crew following around to show what being a private eye really is like. And the two private eyes were played by Miguel Ferrer, and his partner was played by John Slattery, who was relatively an unknown except on stage at that time, but you know, is famous now for Mad Men. And one of the documentary filmmakers, Mos Def. And
you're kidding.
So a charming cast. And like I said, they really had something in a main character of Miguel Ferrer. And it was fun seeing him play a character who was not nearly as smart as he thought he was. So it gave him a chance to show some vulnerability, but not emotional or sentimental vulnerability, intellectual vulnerability. And that was quite a refreshing opportunity for both pathos and comedy from Miguel Ferrer. So anyway, if you're a Miguel Ferrer fan and you want to see maybe some sides of him that he didn't get a chance to show in supporting work, check out Where's Marlowe.
Where's Marlowe? How weird is that?
I mean, and anyway, Dean Hagland is an actor who I must say sometimes leads with a certain sarcasm, a certain quick wit that can express itself as abrasiveness in his roles, don't you think? And yet,
I guess, yeah.
Beneath that, these are characters that often harbor great feelings of loyalty and friendship.
No, that's true. I had never thought of that.
So I think it's interesting that the two of you would play a director and an actor opposite each other. You know, not that it came to be, but that makes sense.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Now that you say that, that goes up. Oh, that is good casting. Because I didn't really put that together until now, until you mentioned.
I mean, so
there is similarities.
So often a director and an actor, right, if it's going to work, they mirror each other in some interesting ways, right? That the actor is able to embody and reveal what the director is exploring. And so that makes sense in a fictional film. I think that's really quite, you know, in a film within a film structure, that really makes
structure,
a lot of sense.
Finally,
I just wanted to say also like Dean Hagland.
Yes.
Were you not a drummer at one point in your life?
I certainly was a drummer in a punk rock band there, too.
Miguel Ferrer was an accomplished drummer before turning to acting. Sound familiar?
What?
He played in bands, toured with his mother and Bing Crosby, and recorded with The Who's Keith Moon as a drummer.
Wow. Well, now there's an illustrious career, eh?
But just another thing that it turns out that you would have had in common, you know? I mean,
isn't that
fascinating?
Yeah, that is fascinating. Now I wish we made that stupid movie.
Yeah, yeah. If you have the script, it would be really interesting to dust it off and read it and kind of imagine, you know, what might have really worked and come out of that. Anyway, we do need to move on because, again, this is a special show, our fifth such special theme show of this year 10. But before we get to that, we have a letter from a listener we promised to get to. I'll reread it and reset the stage. Hello, Dean and Phil. Over the holiday, I was able to see Star Wars Rogue One, really enjoyed the film. Blah, 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 blah. In the course of the film, I read it all last week. If people need to hear the whole thing, they can go back. But I want to get to the question so we can get to the answer. In the course of the film, there was an appearance by Grand Moff Tarkin, portrayed by Peter Cushing, who passed away in 1994, as well as a much younger version of Carrie Fisher's version of Princess Leia. The effect was done through the use of a live actor performing the role on set, then digitally altering the character to match the actor who originally portrayed them. Here's some detailed information to check out. And by the way, it's interesting that we're coming to this now rather than when it was written to us, because, of course, this is an issue that we're going to be facing with Carrie Fisher potentially in not the next Star Wars film, because she'd finished her work on that, but on Star Wars Episode 9, where apparently Princess Leia has a major role, and of course none of that was filmed. The film raises some important issues about the use of this effect. Although Carrie Fisher gave the full blessing for the use of her image in this film prior to her untimely death, this technology wasn't even dreamt up when Peter Cushing passed. One has to wonder if Cushing's estate gave permission or received any compensation, and with Fisher's passing, will her image continue to be used in Star Wars films, et cetera. So there's a lot to unpack here.
Yes.
And also, obviously, Agent Summer, who wrote this, wanted to know, as we weigh in on this, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, what would it feel like to see Dean as Langley in The X-Files 3093?
Well, exactly.
So, but let's go on the record again in case we didn't mention this last week. Cushing's estate was remunerated for this, and they approved the usage. So let's make sure that to be a given. I mean, we cannot, even if their image, like Marilyn Monroe, is in the public domain, let's all just agree that there's certain things we should not do. And manipulating someone's image and creating new work from it is something, even if it's legal, it doesn't make it all right. Let's make sure that the family, that those with a real emotional stake, even if, like I said, they don't have a financial stake, let's make sure they give their blessing. Let's make sure they're okay with it.
Well, but here's the thing. You sign, well, not you, you personally, a contract is signed that often has stipulated in it use of likeness in present and future technologies. I've signed more than one contract that has stated that in no uncertain terms. And this is the future technology that I'm sure they're referring to.
But you're misreading that. It means that your filmed performance can be exploited in future technologies. It does not mean that they can create new work from you. In fact, the Marlon Brando was the one that was able to end that with Superman and Superman 2, because the Salkinds were famous for filming enough material for the movie you thought you were making. And they were actually making two movies so that their sequel, a la The Four Musketeers, they wouldn't have to pay any of the actors. They did not, because they filmed the whole thing. So now they do have to pay you if they're creating a new performance, but not if they are in any way manipulating it to reissue that performance beyond residuals, of course.
Of course.
In other media. So no, they can't create, they don't have the right to create a new performance. From your, as long as you're alive, and then as long as your estate holds license rights. Even if it's in character, they can't do it without negotiating that. So that's where we're at
so
right
now.
That's
good news.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, I, like everybody else, has had their head scanned three-dimensionally.
You said like everyone else. I've never had my head scanned three-dimensionally.
Well, like every other actor that has an action figure made of them. Let's
go
with that.
That is a smaller category than everyone.
Okay, you're right. I think everybody else has gone through it, but you're right. Not everyone has. So you get your head scanned.
You're proving what Donald Trump and his supporters say, that Hollywood is very much out of touch. Wait, you mean everyone doesn't have their own action figure?
What? There's not a 3D head scan of each and every person that you hold on your laptop as an object file? Oh. Okay, well, that's news to me. Anyway, by the very fact I have that, I can then give it to an animator who can then recreate my performance. Or it could be, you know, technically just shared if I give it to one house, one animation house that are doing it that I consent to, what stops them from just dropping that on a thumb drive and giving it to someone else to do whatever with? So it becomes very much that you become a digital entity that can be manipulated left, right, and center. So I see this being a problem for sure. And it's been going on for some time. I mean, think of Oliver Reed died during the making of Gladiator. Even Fred Astaire dancing with a vacuum cleaner for a commercial. I mean, all of that.
And let's not. It's not just dead actors. I mean, it's also taking older actors, a la Carrie Fisher, and making them young. We saw this used, I think, to maybe the best effect for my money in Ant-Man, where they make Michael Douglas, who's a key figure at his present age in the movie, but in an opening sequence, they need him young, and instead of recasting it, they make him youthful. In this case, he was, in fact, the actor who was embodying it, and then they used the CGI to make him younger. And I thought it was a good effect, especially because it's only one scene, and you're willing to suspend your disbelief when you understand, to a degree, okay, he's growing into the Michael Douglas we know, and that character is going to be a major part of this.
Right.
But I think it starts, it's no different than any other conversation about making a project and casting. The first question still has to be, should this story be made? Not,
right,
can you sell it? Not, can you market it? Is this a story that ought to be made? That needs to be made? A story that you have some personal investment in telling beyond it being a smart business move? And I would argue, if you can't say yes to that, then no, it shouldn't be made, or these should not be the people making it. Okay, that's the first one.
Right.
And then if you get to the point where yes, and it's going to be made, or the powers that be say, fuck you, we'll get somebody else and we're going to make it anyway, then you still have to go to the next question, which is, okay, does this character actually need to be in it? And this is a question that all writers should be asking even before they know who's cast to play parts in something. When
right.
you're writing something, is this character truly necessary? Because if the character isn't, and boy, most of the time when we're watching movies, there's a lot of characters in each movie that don't need to be in there. And I hate that.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's disrespectful to an audience. It's disrespectful for the actors who are playing it. Yeah, they get a payday and everything, but if they're in it, give them a reason to be in it that affects the audience, that affects the characters on their journey, the main characters on their journey. So does the character
right.
need to be in it? If not, well, then you've already solved the problem. Not,
right.
oh, well, it's a marketing angle if we bring this character in for a cameo. Okay, fine, but is the cameo needed on some thematic, some kind of textual, some kind of emotional level?
Right.
We can say, certainly with Rogue One, that Peter Cushing's character of Grand Moff Tarkin was needed. There is no way to do a thing set a story set on the Death Star during its completion that does not involve the governor who is running the Death Star. There's no
right.
Now it's a different question, should this story be told? I'm not even going to address that one, but I think a lot of people would say yes. Okay, so if we assume the answer was yes, well then I would say absolutely the character of Grand Moff Tarkin needs to be in it. Did the Princess Leia? No, she didn't need to be. And interestingly enough, that CGI really doesn't work so well. It's distracting. It's like Tom Hanks in the Polar Express creepy. And
right.
You think it's going to be great moment, and then, because the highlight moment is before that when you see all the rebel guards dying, trying to get her the plans. But so isn't that interesting? Now, there's different technical
yeah.
challenges from taking someone dead and someone old and carving out that face versus taking a pre-existing actor who's still alive, still recognizable, and making that face young. It's a different challenge. I don't understand it. what goes into it, of course. I don't do this work, but I don't think it's a coincidence that the character that was needed ends up coming off effective, and the one that wasn't needed is a distraction.
Interesting.
And then once you say, does that character need to be in it, you then have to ask yourself, can that character only be played by that deceased individual, or can the role be recast? Can you imagine the Harry Potter movies if they decided, well, we need to stick with Richard Harris? No, they recast that part with the equally great Michael Gambon. And honestly, that was the better call, no matter what you think about CGI, but it was a better call because Michael Gambon more embodied the character of Dumbledore in those books. In the early books, it was very much seeming to be a template for a Richard Harris performance. But in the later books, Michael Gambon has in his essence much more what was needed. So they recast it, and everyone is fine with the recasting, not just because Richard Harris is dead, but also because this recasting works.
Right.
So can that character only be played by that individual? And if we say that it is so iconic, or it would be so distracting that another actor played it, well, then I guess you have your answer. Yes, it must be played by that individual, which then brings us to the same issue you have as a director and a storyteller all the time, which is, okay, the quality of the performance that we need.
Right.
And here's your big problem, the big place where it can be tripped up so easily. Any performance has to be built from the inside out. And yet, the emphasis on a CGI performance is all too often from the outside in, making it look right. Well, when actors are concerned about how something looks, you tell me, is that performance authentic ever?
Well, no. I mean, well, there is a way of doing that through a French training of La Hoc, but that still, you have to have an inner fire going.
Yeah.
And if you're not, then because, it's going to be completely dead. It's almost like the uncanny valley in robotics, right? You can put all the muscles and stuff in a robotic face, but there's still something missing, even though it sort of looks right. There's that last essence missing.
Any performance, the beginning of any performance for an actor is to embody the energy, the unique energy of that character. What is the energy they're experiencing then? What is the energy? How is the energy affected by their location, their circumstances? Where do they carry that energy? That lets us know how this person walks through the world, that they do walk through the world prior to us seeing them for the purposes being expressed in the plot. It lets us know we're seeing someone real. And then the actor tries to connect that energy to the emotional reality the character is facing. And the actor then explores how those two inform and affect each other. Right? The dialogue and the facial expressions and all of this don't get planned out. They get expressed by the emotional reality and the energy of the character and how those things interact. So in the case of the Grand Moff Tarkin performance in Rogue One, I think whoever it was that did the physical embodiment did a masterful job, as good as we could expect. We saw that character and we really walked away feeling like we had been given a new Peter Cushing performance.
Right.
The person who embodied Princess Leia embodied absolutely nothing. And wasn't given an opportunity to either, might I say, because it's just a money shot.
Right.
And because we don't get to... And by the way they introduce Grand Moff Tarkin, before you get to see his face, which is reflected, shadowy reflection, you've already gotten to see the body and how the character carries himself, and you've already learned so much about it. There's no opportunity for the Princess Leia moment to be led
play
into
like that.
Yeah. So these are the issues that I think, just as a storyteller, you need to consider, and you have to keep asking yourself these questions at every step. Are you building it from the inside? Because after all, as we know, story comes from within characters. It does not get imposed upon characters.
Look at that. Another masterclass from Phil Lernes, ladies and gentlemen.
And maybe we're about to talk about some films that fail to do that, because this is the fifth here in year 10 of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. To commemorate year 10, we decided to do 10 what kind of shows, Garrett Watley?
Top 10.
That's right. 10 top 10 shows. And this is our fifth what, Garrett Watley?
Top 10.
Right. As we count down, how many of the worst films of 2016, Garrett Watley?
Top 10.
Right. So we go with our top 10 worst films of 2016. Do you want to get us started, Dean Haglund?
Well, you know, this hurts every year because no one goes out of their way to make a bad film. Everybody tries really hard to do stuff and to try to make the best that they could possibly do. And yet you end up with so many disasters. I don't know. This list I have has no particular order. A lot of it I watched on the plane, so it was easy to turn these off. So maybe I didn't hold out to the end on a couple of these.
But that's all right. I mean, that's a reason why there's if they've lost you, they've lost you. Okay.
They lost me, yeah. And a lot of this, as we're speaking, what's the reason to tell us? And is it, you know, is there any internal fire, you know,
life.
Anything clicking. There,
yeah, any real life to it. Yeah, because sometimes a movie can be a mess. Sometimes a movie can't work, but it can be an interesting mess because life is messy, right?
Right.
But it has to be alive.
It has to be alive, and you can't just be thinking the superficiality of it. So where to start? Superficiality? I got so many of these things just ride on their insane superficiality. How about we start with Gods of Egypt? Now, did you see this?
This
is a superficial. I mean, it looks like the only reason they made this film is because they had a lot of gold, a lot of gold set pieces. Maybe they put them all out of props, but it just everything was golden, the golden age of Egypt.
Now, this is a big budget film, but, you know, Roger Corman made more than a handful of movies simply because he had sets and costumes left over and he wanted to squeeze every last dollar out of them.
Yeah, but he also then gave, you know, young filmmakers, he said, look, can you do all this for $1 million?
That's a great point. That's a great point. And they would bring some life to it. Even if they were silly, even if they were cheesy, these people would bring life to it. You're absolutely right. But why I brought it up was, like, what you're describing is it's almost like, why should we make this? Well, look at these expensive sets and props we own.
Yeah.
And then the marketing department wrote a script.
Yeah, that's almost exactly what this feels like. You know, I don't know what to say about it other than it was terrible. And I wish I had more information. I mean, it was filmed in Australia to be a backdrop for the Sahara. They thought the Sahara was too dangerous. So they went and filmed in the outback in Australia, where there's no snakes or deadly funnel spiders out there to kill you. So why not?
You know, next week we're going to talk about best films, and I try very much to be a representative of the entire world when celebrating great cinema, and also representative of many different types of filmmaking, genres and forms. I'm not sure I'm going around the world on my worst list, but I am certainly trying to be representative of how bad work can come from any genre as well. I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, that cinema is international. Good cinema is international. Bad cinema is international. And one thing I'd like to point out is you talked about the pain of talking about worst films because nobody goes out of their way to make a bad film. And so what do you celebrate about it? Well, you celebrate the idea that, again, film should have life to it. Art should have life to it. And if it doesn't, it needs to be called out. And but there's a reason that you'll never see a consensus list of worst films of the year. You will see consensus about best, because consensus does form around what's best. But none of us gravitate towards necessarily wanting to see bad movies, first of all. And and bad movies are never going to offend us in the exact same way they will offend someone else.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I have a two-way tie, and I wanted to start with award hopefuls. I wanted to start with award-winning, Oscar-winning directors and how bad their work can be. So I have a tie. I have a tie between Hacksaw Ridge, directed by Mel Gibson, his big comeback vehicle, telling the true story of Desmond Doss. And both these films are true stories, by the way. Amazing how true stories can be absolutely absent of real life. Isn't it? Desmond Doss, it's a great story. He was the conscientious, not objector, as they like to call him, the conscientious participant in World War II, because he enlists, but he just won't carry a gun and he won't kill. But he'll be an army medic. And he was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he won the Medal of Honor, the first conscientious, again, objector slash participant to win the Medal of Honor. That's a great story. And in the hands of Mel Gibson and his cast, Andrew Garfield, Sam Worthington, Hugo Weaving, and Vince Vaughn, it's a film that's not only never believable, it fits into that genre I love to call actors in costumes walking around on cheap sets.
Oh, no. Nobody's in...
Nowhere is this thing believable. Not in domestic scenes, not in dating scenes, not in war scenes. I feel like it's Monty Python's World War II.
Is there laughs in there?
And it unintentionally, absolutely. Come back. I've still got one arm. And it's tied for me with Snowden, directed by Oscar winner Oliver Stone, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Shailene Woodley, and an all-star cast. It's the quote-unquote true story of Edward Snowden that is long on myth, short on story, completely absent any drama. A horrible performance by Levitt is paired with a ludicrous performance by Reese Ifans as his CIA mentor. Watch Citizen 4. It's everything Snowden isn't. It's insightful. It's important.
Yeah.
It's exciting. It's suspenseful. It's thought-provoking. It tells a story again. It's everything Snowden isn't.
You're right. I think we talked about that. There was no reason for this movie to be made. I mean, if you had that great documentary that had full access to Snowden, why would you do, at the exact same time, a theatrical telling of that story?
Yeah. I mean, Snowden is literally shot while it's going on, the documentary, Citizen 4. And anyway, so what do you got? What's your number 9?
Okay, so this one wow, what a mess this one is. It's called London Has Fallen. Have you seen this one?
No, but I love these that you're choosing. I mean, I know of these, absolutely. I know of these. They may even be in my queue, and yet I'm never going to watch either of them.
You're never going to watch any of them. I think this has your man crush in it, too, doesn't it?
Benedict Cumberbatch?
No, not that guy.
Clive Owen?
This up here.
It's not Clive Owen.
Clive Owen.
No, it's Gerard Butler, and I don't know.
Oh, Gerard Butler. Yeah.
Right.
So isn't that funny? Because he's in also the Gods of Egypt thing.
Very funny. Very funny, especially if you're his representatives.
Yeah, I'm sure they're laughing. All the world leaders come to some, you know, whatever meeting, and they all get assassinated, even though they're not all at the same, they're all getting assassinated all over London at the exact same time. And it's up to Gerard to single-handedly save the American president for some reason. So they have a wild shoot up and drive all over to London and get to blow up bridges digitally. And then it sort of falls apart from there, if you can imagine. So
it starts off bad and tapers off to horrible.
Yeah, basically. There's no... it seems that everybody... Well, I know. I read the trivias. They went through 3 or 4 directors on this as everybody kept dropping out. So I'm sure as every director came in, they had a new idea on how to tell this story or... what other part of the story to focus on. So it's got a massive focus problem. because originally you're looking at all the world leaders, then you're looking just at Girard saving the president, and then it's now the bridge is blowing up. Now London is falling. You know,
in the golden age of Hollywood, you would sometimes find these films with multiple directors, even if not all of them were credited, right?
Right.
But Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, and yet great movies could be made of them, and because they didn't lose focus, but because back then you did have a single producer, and maybe that producer was the point of view. But now we live in this corporate era where, I don't know, can you name off the top of your head how many people were listed? It had to be 16 or more people listed as one kind of producer or another in those credits.
Absolutely. I'm just looking at an IMDb, and I see, other than Girard himself is listed as a producer, the list is 10, 15, almost 20, almost 19 producers. There's 19 different producers on this.
Speaking of 19, we have between us now 19 minutes to get to our final 17 films. So let's get there. My number 9. Knight of Cups from director Terrence Malick. It is the worst art house film of the year and the worst Terrence Malick film I have ever seen. Now, like my beloved Robert Altman, who made masterpieces as well as some of the worst films ever, I will defend Terrence Malick's stream of consciousness, style, and approach to my dying day, as it has led to seminal, singular, and emotionally resonant work. And sometimes the material he chooses insufficiently supports his unique approach, and the result will be tortured. And this work is tortured, and it is torture to sit through. And, you know, it again deals with some themes, especially some themes of abuse by one's father that are explored in the masterpiece Tree of Life. A big difference is that Tree of Life ties with the stream of consciousness point of view often of a child. And children are connected still to the wonder of it all. They still feel at one with the entire universe and all of history. And so the approach makes great emotional sense. It's troubling for people who have to intellectualize everything, but it makes great emotional sense. And this, unfortunately, tied with the point of view of not only an adult, but someone in show business. It is beyond at arm's length. It's at arm's length behind glass, this thing. Anyway, Knight of Cups, my number 9. What's your number 8 worst film of the year, Dean Haglund?
Okay, so it's hard to even grasp this one, but Ben-Hur. Dear Lord, Ben-Hur. A remake, of course, of the classic Charlton Heston thing. They really just... they actually focused on two epic stage sequences. One, of course, the chariot race. The other was the as a slave oarsman on the slave galley. They went through incredible lengths of seeing the destruction of that ship and him getting out of the chains and everybody drowning. And Lord, that went on forever. So, clearly, the storyboards were just around those two elements, and then they forgot to write a script, and everything else went straight to hell. The surprise in there is Morgan Freeman as the trainer of the owner of the horses. I guess he owns the horses. And so he's got the disastrous thing of an actor have to do where he's standing in the middle of the horse race and he has to go to each side because they're going in a loop, right? And so he has to call out suggestions, I guess, coaching things as the horses run by and then run to the other side of the track back and forth. It was like, oh, the scene went on forever.
Is it possible that they just shot it guerrilla style at his horse farm in Mississippi? Like he was just doing that and they just filmed it and dropped
just added
it in the movie?
Yeah. I guess, but he was his wardrobe, of course, was massive dreadlocks
CGI.
And some sort of white robe.
CGI.
Anyway, Ben-Hur.
Okay. Couldn't be going more opposite end of the spectrum. Number eight is an independent film called Hello, My Name is Doris. And it's the worst example in 2016 of that unique genre I like to call, quote, former A-list star trying to maintain or regain relevance through an indie dramedy.
Yeah.
It's directed by the god-awful enemy of society, Michael Showalter, who's probably most famous for Long Hot American Summer and its sequel series.
All right.
It's co-written with Laura Taruso. It stars Sally Field, Max Greenfield, Tyne Daly, who is great because even in the wackiness, she roots her character in something real, which no one else ever seems to do in any of Showalter's works. And as for Sally Field herself, this is about a woman, a lonely woman, an older woman who falls in love with her very young boss at her company, and we get to see her fantasy life. And Sally Field is not bad, and she's the whole reason it gets made, and yet she's also the reason it has no chance to work, because she's terribly miscast. Sally Field is kind of cool. She's kind of a cool lady, and it's hard to ever believe she's commenting on what it is to be not only a nerd, but to be an old nerd. She's commenting all the way through it. And so, hello, my name is Doris. Just awful. Number eight.
Yeah.
What's your number seven, Dean Haglund?
Well, okay, so unfortunately, Down Under, we get a different kind of Netflix here. And so I realize some of these films may be a few years old, but this is the year I saw them. And having never heard of it before, I would consider this a 2016 worst movie that I saw. And maybe it's just been dumped in the foreign market. You know, at AFM all those years, we see all these movies that we never hear of, but somehow they get purchased by foreign markets, of which now I live in one. So this thing was, it seemed everything I loved. Nazi moon base, super futuristic worlds, and a sci-fi thing called Iron Sky. Now, have you seen this?
Okay, now let's go back in time many, many years to when this movie was made and released and announced. And you quite seriously said to me, do you see they found proof of Nazi moon bases? And you led me to a very real seeming link and site. We did this on the show. You were not aware that that was actually a trailer for a film, and not just a film, a comedy film. But anyway, there have been multiple of these movies. There's been sequels to this movie.
Has there?
Yeah. So
well, then
you're really digging into the past on this, but I'm glad. I'm glad.
We're so sorry.
The thing that seemed like documentary style proof of Nazi moon bases is nevertheless one of your worst films of the year. See, you're changing your relationship to fake news now that you feel somewhat responsible for Donald Trump becoming elected.
I know. Well, we live in patterns, as you said. It's just our relationship to those patterns is all we can change.
The truth is, this really is bad. I mean, it sounds like it should be so much fun. Even as a Roger Corman-esque comedy, you know, like laughing at it should be fun.
Yeah.
And it's not even fun on that level.
Yeah, I know. It's remarkably void of anything. Fun, action. I mean, the sets kind of look good on some aspects. Yeah, well. Anyway, it's terrible. Don't go see it.
My number seven, I've talked about before on this show. This would be, to me, the worst horror film I saw this year. It's called Lights Out, an American supernatural horror film directed by David Sandberg in his major directorial debut, written by Eric Heisserer. It stars a relatively unknown cast, but also Maria Bello. And it's based on Sandberg's 2013 short film of the same name and same premise. It's a great premise about a person who's photosensitive and so seems to be a monster that's literally disappearing. but is just ultimately incredibly photosensitive after this experiment gone wrong. But there is no reason to expand this fantastic short into a feature. No reason at all, except, well, we can make money off features. And and it's proof positive that you've made a great short film. Congratulations. You know how to make short films. That does not at all mean you know how to make feature films at all. They are entirely different languages. There you go.
Good,
Lights
good
out,
point.
Number seven.
Excellent.
What's your number six?
You let's see. Well, speaking of sci-fi horror, have you seen Spectral?
No, I have not.
Okay, so don't. This is a. This seems to start well in that there's these Marines or ops, black op guys that somehow are facing these supernatural light beings that can go through walls and run really fast. And nobody can figure these things out. And until one guy in one scene goes, "Oh, I got it. Oh, yeah, they're quantum mechanic, blah, blah. You know, they're a weaponized quantum mechanic from the, you know, I'm not even going to try." So while they're all being murdered by these light, weaponized light beams, he says, "Oh, yeah, no, we just have to fight it using something we can just make here." So they just sort of form the weapons in a workshop that can fight giant quantum mechanic light beams, and then there's a massive shootout at some factory in Hungary where they have to unplug the beams. It was like, oh my god, it was even describing it's giving me a headache.
It will not be on your list of the most overlooked sci-fi films of all time.
No, okay. No, and there was clearly money put into this, so there was clearly some thought, but it just a mess of a thing. It's so sad.
Now,
it could have been something.
Now, we're talking about how, you know, something has to have life to it, and life will out. And, you know, when actors are behind something getting made, as with the Sally Field film, there's nothing that is going to stifle any real inner life faster than a star whose main motivation in taking a role or making a film is to try to reclaim or prove their relevancy. When they're coming at it from that point of view, which is so antithetical to really vulnerability, it's going to stifle life so fast. Which brings me to Zoolander 2.
Oh, my God.
Not
That's on my list, too.
Not without laughs. But this sequel, after 15 years to the fondly remembered, yet also equally forgotten, 2001 original, is directed by and starring Ben Stiller. It took four guys to write this. And it stars, again, like I said, Stiller, Owen Wilson, Will Ferrell, Penelope Cruz, Kristen Wiig. And the only reason for this thing to exist is because Stiller fears he's losing his relevancy. And so the whole thing ends up really kind of depressing.
Yeah. Wasn't it depressing? That's what I felt at the end of it. I just went, oh. And I guess it's from his fear of relevancy, but it's also, it seemed that it was repeating the jokes from the first one, just with different supermodels in it. And correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't they the exact same gags in the first one, or was I blurring those two movies in my head?
I don't know. I don't care. What's the difference between ignorance and apathy, Dean Haglund? I don't know, and I don't care.
See what you did? That's a good one.
Okay.
Anyway, that was on my list, too. Let's say that was the next one.
Oh, so that was your number five. All right. Well, that brings me to my number five, written by Chris Terrio and David S. Goyer, directed by Zack Snyder, Distributed by Warner Brothers Pictures, the film is a follow-up to 2013's Man of Steel and is the second installment in the DC Extended Universe. People love Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, and they tolerated Ben Affleck as a Batman. But they do despise Henry Cavill as Superman, and let's face it, the next time Henry Cavill delivers a performance will be the first time he has ever delivered a performance. I understand why Zack Snyder wanted to make Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice. I do understand. It comes through. I understand why this is a story that they wanted to tell, which is why it's only number 5. It does not rank higher on this. But I must say it might be the most incompetent movie I saw all year, given the money behind it, on every level of movie making.
Yeah. Well, to me, and this is on my list too, this is the pressure that you get on a studio with executives breathing down your back and everybody's putting in their 2 cents. This feels very much like too many cooks spoiling the broth.
I'm not sure. I would say, does it really feel surprising, given Man of Steel, given Zack Snyder's track record, does it really seem surprising that it's bad? Maybe it seems surprising that it's this bad, but look, there are Zack Snyder fans, I understand. But in objective conversation, rational, reasonable conversation, he's never made a good movie. He never has. He hasn't proven that he can make a good movie. Now, if you like some of his movies, I enjoyed Watchmen. I really did enjoy Watchmen. I liked the universe building on it. But I know I'm in the minority, even among Zack Snyder fans. Okay? So,
true. Yeah.
And I will readily admit, it's not a good movie. It's a mediocre movie at best. I acknowledge that, though I like it. He's never done anything better than mediocre, so I don't know if you can say it's too many cooks in the kitchen, beyond the fact that maybe it's unprecedentedly bad for him. But Man of Steel was really bad. So,
yeah, that's true.
Anyway.
Well, and I think also they put too much in. I mean, there's too many storylines. Wonder Woman showing up, the Zod Luther genetic mutation. These were all different standalone DC stories that they somehow decided to jam them all into one two-hour thing. And it was like they couldn't trust any one single storyline, so they just had to keep throwing more and more.
You liar. You are a liar. If only it was only 2 hours. If only. If only. It might only be number 6 on my list.
Wait, what's the running time of that?
I have no idea, but it was the longest week of my life.
I saw it on the plane, so, you know.
So are we calling that your number 4?
Let's call that my number 4.
So that brings me to number 4. We're trucking right along here.
Look at us.
Another comic book superhero adaptation, X-Men Apocalypse.
Look at you.
Even writing this down was almost shocking to me to realize it's the 9th installment in the X-Men film series. 9 of them. And it's a sequel, direct sequel to X-Men Days of Future Past, again directed by Bryan Singer, this time with a screenplay by Simon Kinberg from a story conceived by a bunch of people. It took 4 people to come up with no story whatsoever, yet to demand credit. The film stars, as always, an ensemble cast with Messrs. McAvoy and Fassbender back, Jennifer Lawrence back, this time adding Oscar Isaac to the mix, Olivia Munn to the mix. The story involves an ancient mutant who awakens in 1983 and plans to wipe out modern civilization and take over the world, only to find out that that's Bryan Singer's job. It leads the X-Men to try to stop him and defeat his team of renegade mutants. The word that best describes this effort would be craven. This is such a cynical money grab. Bryan Singer always loved the X-Men. We know this. But he didn't love the X-Men nearly as much as he loved Superman, so he left the X-Men series in the incapable, incompetent hands of Brett Ratner so that he could go make the unnecessary Superman Returns movie. Then he comes back, and it is a reminder to us all, I think now, safely, to say that Bryan Singer was once an actual filmmaker. He really,
really?
Was. You know, his early movies, including Usual Suspects, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
He was an actual filmmaker, unlike, as I said before, Zack Snyder,
right.
who has yet to make a film that's better than mediocre. He's not a natural filmmaker. Let's at least put it that way. Singer was every bit a natural filmmaker, and he has squandered all of that. It really reminds me of kind of the career arc of M. Night Shyamalan, although in fairness, apparently Shyamalan's new film doing quite well, getting good reviews. But we can say, okay. right, Shyamalan seemed like a natural. And then, boy, he squandered all of that goodwill that his early works created. There's no reason to go see, if Bryan Singer's name is on something, there's literally no reason to go see it anymore at all.
Yeah, that's true.
X-Men Apocalypse. The veil has been lifted, and the man behind the curtain has been revealed, and that man behind the curtain is just giving us stopwatches for hearts, where he used to actually give us movies and stories. Do you like that? All right. What's your number three, Dean Haglund?
Well, you know, this one's tough because the director and co-writer, we were in acting class together, and he got a start by doing kind of a funny short film where they take the same dialogue and do it three different ways in three different scenarios. And that got him a lot of awards and international attention that got him to where he got now, which is Kevin James in the true memoirs of the international assassin. Now, have you seen this?
No, this I did not. This, I think, went straight to Netflix here. But
did it? Well, that's where I saw it for sure. But I assumed it had a theatrical release somewhere else in the world, and it was just dumped here on Netflix because it was so awful. And not just awful. I mean, your plot line is he writes action books, you know, and somebody says, "Oh, these are all true stories," and then he's taken hostage by the bad guys and so on and so forth, and he can't do anything he says he can do in the books. And so then the hot woman helps him. You know, it's almost by the numbers at that point. But Kevin James, of course, did I ever find him funny? I guess some of his stand-up was funny at one time. But boy, now he does not give a shit at all. And really just everybody seemed to be just phoning this one in. It's,
I think if Netflix keeps making these kind of movies with him, with Adam Sandler, where they take the
right.
money and they don't care, and Netflix doesn't care because they know their demographics so well, I think there's no faster way to losing those demographics than not caring. You know?
Yeah. One day that well's gonna dry up. I mean, regardless of if you're just taking your money from subscriptions. And that's your only concern. You're right. Everybody's going to cancel their Netflix subscription if that's all they're showing.
My number three, you mentioned, Shane, because you went to school with the director. I'm a big fan of this director, James Bobbin, who co-created and showran my beloved Flight of the Conchords. And,
oh, of course.
He replaces Tim Burton for a sequel to Alice in Wonderland called Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Oh,
now,
yes.
You already have a problem because the storyline of the original Alice in Wonderland was actually borrowed much more heavily from Alice Through the Looking Glass. So now you've
right.
got a title with no story, and, well, there's my review for the film. You have a title with no story. My second, by the way, on my list to star... Rhys Ifans, oddly enough. It of course stars Johnny Depp, Anne Hathaway, Mia Wasikowska, Helena Bonham Carter, Sacha Baron Cohen. So in other words, a whole lot of people that should have known better, not the least of which poor Alan Rickman in his final film role.
Oh, no.
But you just hope they were all paid well. The story is something about a search for something called a chronosphere, which involves time travel, which begs the question, when they find it, can I use it and go back and never have to have seen Alice through the looking glass. What's your number two, Dean Haglund?
That's funny because that was almost on my list, but I went, yeah, I turned it off really early on the plane, so I don't think I can have it fully.
You turned it off
there.
Early? To that,
yeah.
I can only say, go fuck yourself. Okay, number two, Dean Haglund.
What? Because you sat through the whole thing.
Yeah, because I sat through the whole thing. What I meant to say was, I'm glad I took one for the team.
Well, okay, so, you know, speaking of a great title and that seems to have it all, you would think this movie would be even somewhat enjoyable, but Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies... Good Lord.
Now, I know this director. I know him. But
oh,
anyway,
do you?
Yeah, he used to be an actor. You, I represented one of his films when I was in... Yeah. Okay, I didn't bother to see this, and I was actually looking forward to this. I thought this could be fun, but...
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Well, what you know, what's fun about a zombie movie is the learning that there's zombies. However, what they decide to do in this one...
I thought you were going to say when it ends.
Yeah, no, this one they're already living with zombies and they're quite comfortable with it, and it's just there's very little zombie fighting going on, and when it is, it's often done in slow motion, and so your whole motor for a zombie movie is an attack of zombies and you have to protect yourself. Well, they've removed that in this one and focus more on the Jane Austen part, the relationships of the girls and getting them married off. So what can I say? What a swing and a miss on this one. And it was all laid out for you, really. And that you flub it this badly? You can't even armchair direct this one out of its deep hole that it dug.
Number two for me, Independence Day Resurgence.
Oh.
Unlike Zoolander 2, this sequel, well past its sell-by date, was one I actually held cautious optimism for, as you know. I was thinking it might just provide the same gee-whiz B-picture delights of the first installment.
Right.
And it does not. And I blame in part Will Smith for not being in it. Right. For choosing to do Suicide Squad instead, because he, looking back, really embodied some of that B picture daring do from the 1950s that we love. And he embodied it so naturally. And there's no one doing anything naturally in this movie. In this, everything is so hardworking. Even Jeff Goldblum, God bless him, takes his comic relief responsibilities so seriously that he just seems to be commenting on those responsibilities.
No.
Mostly, though, here's the problem, and it never occurred to me. You know, the first one was a fun B-movie viewpoint on our then-contemporary society. Right?
Right.
It was a B-movie depiction of what life in 1996 was. But,
right, trailer living, all that.
But this one has to do the hard work of changing the world to account for the introduction of alien technology in 1996. So this world where this is set is not our world at all. It's now an entirely alternate universe from our own, which sets this movie irrevocably on the wrong tone from the outset.
Right.
So this thing had, in retrospect, no chance of working if what working means is to recapture that sense of effortless fun of the first one. It had no chance.
Because no film lives in a vacuum. It's all in context. And that brings me to my number one. Because you can't go and see Absolutely Fabulous without going, wow, it was easy to watch in 20-minute increments, but to see 2 hours of that wears on you pretty quick. And B, it really was a context of the 90s, you know, that all of this excess and frivolity and irresponsibility was funny, as opposed to seeing it now, which is not just not funny, but slightly disturbing, actually. And and it's morally you have a hard time relating to the characters, and also then the actors doing it, you kind of go, oh, why did you decide to do this? Is it a money grab as well? It's so terrible. It actually hurt. It actually hurt to watch this. Wow. Absolutely fabulous. Yeah. I know.
Well, I want to share with you, before I get into my number one, one of my favorite stories about a very good acting teacher we both know. I will not mention this teacher's name, but this teacher is famously, if he has a weakness as an acting teacher, it's that he's too nice. He's too easy on his students. When sometimes really dropping the hammer to encourage them to delve deeper would be what they need.
Right.
But this was one class where he was so offended, not only on his own behalf, but on behalf of everyone else who was working hard, that this person had so not cared to do any work at all, had just really taken a flying dump over the noble profession that is acting. And so he criticized the person. And this person, acting completely defensively, says, well, didn't you like anything about my performance? And this teacher said, I liked when it ended. And that reminds me of my number one worst film of the year. And that is written and directed by David Ayer, an ensemble cast by Will Smith, led by Will Smith, who deserves a lot of the blame for choosing to do this instead of Independence Day Resurgence, because having a bona fide movie star in a what is supposed to be an equal ensemble throws everything out of balance from the very beginning.
Oh, right.
And
of course,
means that Suicide Squad has no chance of working. Now, it had no chance of working anyway because it was so completely ill-conceived, because having Will Smith play someone who is supposed to be a vile, irredeemable villain and murderer, bloodthirsty killer, who ultimately redeems himself, well, of course he's going to redeem himself. He's Will Smith. The Dirty Dozen worked because there's a very real chance that all these people in a group led by Lee Marvin are going to be truly reprehensible. And
right.
Here, no, you're winking at us by giving us Will
right.
Smith as someone who's the leader of this. And it's supposed to be an ensemble anyway. Completely ill-conceived. A script that went through a shredder many, many times, not just when Tom Hardy sent it through one in rejecting it and sending it back. Look, there is no point to this film even existing. At least Batman versus Superman, there, like I said, there's some sense of what story Zack Snyder wanted to tell, even if he was ill-equipped to tell it and ended up telling it poorly. There was some sense of it. This is quite simply as bad as corporate filmmaking can ever get, and yet I truly, truly loved that it ended.
Yeah. But I think you hit the nail. It's corporate filmmaking. And I think now we got to, I think in future top 10 worst lists, we really got to separate where there was a failure and where corporate shenanigans screwed the thing over. So to me, that's like two different things. One, to assess why a film failed artistically and find solutions or have learning moments. You can do that from independent films. But this corporate filmmaking cycle that we're in, I would think that there's really no lessons to be gained for the young filmmakers out there.
That brings us to an end of another exciting installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We're back next week with another top 10 show, number 6 of 10 we're doing on this year 10. You can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com.
Think of that.
Download them.
Stream it. You can download them. You can even subscribe via iTunes. Write a review if you like.
What could be more fun?
I don't know.
Like us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Write us, as Agent Summer did for this show, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram with the same handle, Dean and Phil.
That's
spell out the word and.
At Dean and Phil, hashtag we give good hashtags. I think that's everything. Mm-hmm. Until next week.
I think so.
I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.